Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with a prisoner release in Afghanistan and Guantanamo, where an American sergeant was swapped for five Taliban prisoners in a deal brokered by the Emir of Qatar. Vali Nasser, who served as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in the Obama administration and is the author of The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat, joins us to discuss whether this deal is a precursor for a wider deal in the works with the Taliban and the Haqqani network, who have been holding the American prisoner since 2009. Then we will speak with London-based writer and lecturer in journalism at the University for the Creative Arts, Mohammed Idris Ahmad, about indications the Obama administration may be re-engaging in Syria after years of ambivalence about intervening, during which time Islamist extremists have entrenched themselves in the rebellion against the Assad dictatorship to the point that they have been a boon to Bashar al-Assad, who has made a comeback while his country is being destroyed. We'll also look into Dr. Ahmad's article at the LA Review of Books, A Dangerous Method, Syria, Cy Hirsch, and the Art of Mass Crime Revisionism, and why the left, who used to be champions of human rights and opposed to dictators, have more recently come to the defense of murderous regimes, often making excuses for Milosevic, Gaddafi, and Assad. Then finally, on the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre and the death of the student-led democratic movement in China, we will examine the Communist Party leadership's crackdown on any possible dissent by jailing prominent scholars and activists and warning Western journalists to stay away from the square in the coming days. Scott Kennedy, the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business at Indiana University, joins us to discuss the official amnesia in China over what happened 25 years ago, and acrimonious exchanges between Defense Secretary Hagel and a Chinese general who denies China is destabilizing the region in disputes over islands in the South China Sea. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. His books include The Shia Revival, Democracy in Iran, and his latest, now in paperback, is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And what is I have a suspicion, Vali Nasser, that the release of these American sergeant and these five Taliban prisoners in this swap is perhaps a precursor for something more, because isn't that pretty much how these arrangements are made? The president's not going to deal seriously with the Taliban unless they release an American prisoner, and that would be, having done that, one assumes that they'll get onto a more important agenda.
Well, there is no doubt that this deal is an important first step, because there hasn't been a concrete deal around peace talks between the United States, Afghanistan, and the Taliban since 2009. However, since the United States is leaving Afghanistan, what might follow this prisoner exchange would have to be serious peace talks between the Afghan government, the new Afghan president, and the Taliban. I would suspect that the United States will play now a lesser role in the peace talks, largely because we no longer have a prisoner there to need to talk to the Taliban about. And since there is a plan for withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan at any rate, that the United States will probably play a less direct role in the peace talks, but it will encourage the Afghan government to do so more seriously.
Well, the United States apparently kept this deal from Hamid Karzai, Afghan's president, I presume because they don't trust him.
Well, it's absolutely correct, because Karzai has been talking from both sides of his mouth when it comes to peace talks with the Taliban. On the one hand, he was very eager for being allowed to talk to the Taliban. But on the other hand, every time the Qataris made a positive move with the Taliban, it was Karzai who undermined it. And for the United States, the release of Sergeant Bergdahl was very important, above and beyond just the peace talks. And they did not wish to give Karzai the ability to play politics with this. For instance, try to hold up the conclusion of this deal for something that he wants from the United States. And as a result, this ended up being a much more direct United States-Taliban deal than an Afghan peace process success story, which is usually the way in which we've promoted the reconciliation talks.
But what is the role of the Haqqani network in this? They've apparently been holding the American sergeant, and they are often referred to as the Taliban, but they are a distinct group and have been largely, as far as I understand, under the protection of the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI.
Well, the Haqqanis are probably one of the most vicious and also militarily effective components of the Taliban. They have a seat at the Taliban Shura, which is the council, the high council of the Taliban, but they are a separate unit within the Taliban. So they have their own operational and command structure. They have their own leadership. They have their own fighters. But they're a big piece of the Taliban, and they're the one that has carried out some of the worst attacks in Kabul, in the south, and it's a very effective fighting force. Now, the fact that it was possible to make a deal with this particular faction of the Taliban is also significant, because it is suggestive that it is possible to make deals. It's going to be difficult. It's not always going to be successful, but we had not had an example of a successful deal that was actually carried through. And to that extent, this is a positive signal.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. His books include The Shia Revival, Democracy in Iran, and his latest, now in paperback, is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. But one has to assume, I think, Vali Nasser, that Pakistan played a role in this, given how much the rumors, I think, are so prevalent that one has to assume that the ISI has had fairly intimate connections with the Haqqani network. And when you and Richard Holbrooke were trying to deal with this overall region, my understanding is that what frustrated you both was, one, that you couldn't deal on Kashmir, that was somehow taken off the table, so you couldn't deal with the bigger issue, which is India and Pakistan, the friction between them, in turn making it easier to deal with Pakistan. And in this case, my understanding is that there are now divisions within the Pakistani Taliban, and that the Pakistani government are now kind of having kind of buyer's remorse, if you will, about the extent to which they have supported the Taliban, because now they're worried about reverse sanctuary, that if the Taliban take over in Afghanistan, they may well be able to launch attacks from Afghanistan back into Pakistan. So is it let's start with that question. Is it true that the Pakistanis are having second thoughts about what they've wrought?
I don't think so. I think this is much more complicated than that. I think the Taliban actually have been very useful for America, for Pakistan's intelligence services in achieving their strategic objectives in Afghanistan. And Pakistan still has strategic objectives in Afghanistan. And therefore, I don't think they see the way in which they've deployed the Taliban in Afghanistan as having failed. Now, there has been blowback in Pakistan in terms of festering of Taliban within Pakistan, but I think Pakistanis treat that as a separate problem, and these are separate groups, and their targets are separate, and their objectives are separate. Now, I think what is a problem for Pakistan is that now that the United States is leaving the region, and it's not keeping the Taliban within Afghanistan busy with fighting, it would be more difficult for the Pakistanis to follow the policy that they had before, which was fight the Taliban at home and support the Taliban in Afghanistan as they fight the Americans. That's become much more difficult for them. So I think the Pakistanis have much better relationship with the Taliban that are fighting in Afghanistan, the Haqqanis included, than they have with the Taliban that are within their own territory. Now, whether the Pakistani Taliban will create a common front with the Afghan Taliban, it all depends on what kind of a policy the Pakistanis adopt against their own Taliban. They are currently debating whether they should take him on militarily or whether they should engage in negotiations with their own Taliban along the lines that we now see have happened in Qatar, which led to the release of Sergeant Bergdahl.
So in terms of, though, of a holistic deal, a broader deal for the region, which I understand you and Richard Holbrooke were tried to engage in the first place, is there any indication that, for example, the new leadership in India who've met with his Pakistani counterpart, is that possible? Because my understanding is that the Pakistanis are completely paranoid about India's influence in Afghanistan, and which I think they've largely exaggerated, but it is very much what's driving them, is it not, to want to control the future of Afghanistan?
Well, you know, we're in a world right now in which we think everybody has exaggerated strategic fears. Russia with Ukraine, China with the South China Sea and Japan, and, you know, the Pakistanis with Indian influence in Afghanistan. That may very well be the case, but these strategic fears are real, and they actually do animate countries' behaviors in ways that are very troubling to us. I mean, Ukraine is evidence of that. Now, you know, the Pakistanis do view an independent, strong, Pashtun-dominated Afghanistan as a natural ally of India in a strategic great game in South Asia. And there is historical reason for them to be actually worried. Now, I think there's always a scope for India and Pakistan to arrive at some kind of a agreement over Afghanistan and that would bring a certain degree of peace to the region. But with the United States' interest in South Asia declining, it's probably there's going to be less international support for this than was the case a few years back, because when we started with Richard Holbrooke in 2009, the United States was very interested in getting Afghanistan and getting Pakistan and India on the same page, because that would have created a much greater regional support, or at least regional common understanding around America's objectives in Afghanistan. Now that we are no longer engaged in the fighting in Afghanistan, we are no longer as motivated to facilitate a Pakistani-Indian understanding over Afghanistan. It's up to them to figure this out, whether it's in their own interest to do so or not. And I am generally not very hopeful that they will, largely because there is a lot of baggage between these two countries, and they do need some degree of outside assistance to allow them to get over some hurdles in their relationship. And that is not there. And the greatest fear is that now you have a powerful Hindu nationalist prime minister, and it's very tempting for extremists like the Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan to repeat an attack in India along the lines of the Mumbai attack, because that can very quickly escalate into a massive confrontation between these two countries. And I think what we might see going forward is as likely to be a case of confrontation as understanding between these two countries.
But isn't one of the ironies here that if this new Hindu nationalist government starts to indicate its extremist bent domestically, isn't it likely to sever one of the great sort of unities that country has? There's, I think the Muslim population of India is almost equal to that of the entire population of Pakistan. And if India, that would be the ultimate self-inflicted wound, wouldn't it, if India alienates its own Muslim population?
No, I think that population is to a larger extent alienated. And I think the fear is that the way Prime Minister Modi dealt with the Muslims in Gujarat was to put them in their place as a minority, and to assert Hindu nationalism's domination. And now he may not be eager to repeat that. He may have other priorities for India. But I think there is such a high level of expectation of him showing the iron fist. If Pakistani extremists or Pakistan in any way provoke India, that it's very difficult for him not to overreact. I think, his own background, his own constituency, the dynamic of internal Indian politics makes it very difficult for him not to react much more aggressively than the Congress party did in the face of the Mumbai attack. And that is exactly what is the incentive of extremist groups, knowing well that Modi is bound to and is likely to be pressured to react aggressively, not to provoke him. I mean, if the extremist game is to create a trouble in the region, then a provocation against India in the next year or so could very well achieve that goal.
Well, Osama bin Laden's provocation to George W. Bush certainly worked out that way, did it not? In the sense that...
Absolutely. I mean, the logic of terrorism, going back to the 1970s, Europe, Latin America, long before we arrived at 9/11, is to use shocking violence as a way of forcing a provocation that then translates into something much bigger. And the terrorists always end up in the process being decimated. But they have shown that a few people using shocking tactics can provoke much larger forces and into action that then find a logic of their own. So here you have two nuclear-powered countries deeply distrustful of one another. One of them, Pakistan, does have relationship with the extremists. But the extremists' own objective is not peace and prosperity, is not a common ground between India and Pakistan, but is a provocation of a much larger confrontation that they think in their own view of the world will benefit them. And therefore, now they might look at India and think that the situation is ripe, because you have a nationalist prime minister that's bound to respond much more aggressively. If he does so, then Pakistan will have to reciprocate. And then that puts South Asia in a very different plane. And I think Islamic extremists in South Asia very much like a polarized situation between Hindus and Muslims, between India and Pakistan, because they think it moves the political arena, the political discussion in their direction.
Well, just in closing then, Vali Nasser, back to the prisoner swap and objections coming from Republicans about the president's using the Emir of Qatar and making this deal where the Taliban, so-called high-value prisoners from Guantanamo, have got to stay in Qatar for a year. There's talk about how somehow the president's violated congressional prerogatives over Guantanamo. Are these likely to amount to anything?
Well, I think the criticisms of the president on this by the Republicans is misplaced. I think it would not have been good for the United States to be leaving Afghanistan and leaving behind a trump card in the hand of the Haqqani network. And I think it's important that as the United States is winding down its presence over there, that it doesn't leave any loose ends. Secondly, the Guantanamo prisoners are going to be under the custody of government of Qatar. I think, again, it is too much is made out of what the current value of these prisoners, even if you let them out after so many years, whether they would have any value more than symbolic to the constituencies they come from. And given that they're going to be under somebody else's prison instead of Guantanamo, they're still in prison. They're still not free. And I think the Taliban or the Haqqanis could not have freed an American. They could not arrive at a deal without being able to show that they got something for it. And this is as least as we could have given them for Sergeant Bergdahl. And I think it was largely a good deal for the United States.
Well, Vali Nasser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's good speaking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who is the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. His books include The Shia Revival, Democracy in Iran, and his latest, now in paperback, is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. We're going to take a brief station break and go to London to talk about why the left, who used to be champions of human rights and opposed to dictators, have more recently come to the defense of murderous regimes, often making excuses for Milosevic, Gaddafi, and Assad.